It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last night, President Obama renewed his commitment to investing in renewable energy while, he said, responsibly developing domestic oil and natural gas deposits.
There's no reason why Congress shouldn't at least set a clean energy standard that creates a market for innovation. So far, you haven't acted. Well, tonight, I will. I'm directing my administration to allow the development of clean energy on enough public land to power 3 million homes.
Well, what does this mean for the economy and the environment? We zoom in now on America's progress on energy over the last few years.
We asked Michael Kraft, professor emeritus of political science at UW-Green Bay, to help put all this in perspective. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, one of the cases the president made is that the United States is moving toward energy independence, not a place we thought we'd be even maybe a decade ago. How accurate is that?
It's fairly accurate. You may recall back in the 1970s, every president, Nixon, Ford, and Carter, talked about the need to move towards energy independence. We actually went in the opposite direction. And by 2005, we imported, this is a reference to importing oil to power transportation, largely cars and trucks. And the latest forecast I saw just the other day from the Department of Energy is by this year, by the end of this year, we will be at 32%. That is 32% of the oil we use will come from outside the United States. And the projection is within perhaps a decade, we will be completely independent and use only domestic sources. The reason, of course, is we have greatly increased oil and gas production through the fracturing or fracking process that the president mentioned.
And that's not been cause for celebration for everyone. That environmentalists in particular say right. That fracking comes with a downside.
Right. So it's a two-sided development. Having more domestic oil is something that Republicans in particular have long argued. Some will recall the drill, baby, drill philosophy of 2008. The president and many Democrats were reluctant at first, and then eventually they did endorse more oil and gas production on public lands, and the Obama administration clearly has done that. Environmentalists are concerned on at least two fronts. One is that fracking may result, there's not a lot of evidence for this, may result in some contamination of surface and groundwater. But the real concern is natural gas is still a fossil fuel, and as the president noted, eventually we need to move away from fossil fuels. But he highlighted the fact that natural gas is what he calls a bridge fuel. It's better than coal, produces half the greenhouse gases of burning coal. It's probably better than oil if we can power vehicles through natural gas, and there's some developments there. But eventually we have to move toward other energy sources, producing electricity through solar or wind or biofuels, and then powering our cars through electricity.
What kind of progress has there been? There's been some federal government support, some notable false starts, and companies that failed after getting loans. But behind that, right. Is there an uptick in those alternative sources?
Oh absolutely. Some will recall that as part of the economic renewal package in 2009, the government invested tens of billions of dollars in energy research and development projects, a good portion of which went to solar and wind. So the critics will point to the company Solyndra, which received a rather large amount of federal funds and then went bankrupt. But a Brookings Institution study showed that the vast majority of money was actually well spent. And it was, as the president noted last night, was creating jobs and producing viable new technologies that when they become more fully commercial will help us, again, achieve energy independence, but also move away from the use of fossil fuel. About 83% of the energy we use in the United States and about the same number around the world comes from fossil fuels. So it's really hard, as the president said, we don't do this overnight. You can't replace 83% of the energy with solar power overnight. But what you do need to do is invest money in very smartly directed programs to develop new technologies and then push the most promising of those. And that is something the administration has done. The other side that he noted very briefly was the auto fuel efficiency improvements. On two occasions, the Obama administration has sharply increased auto fuel efficiency standards, and that's going to help achieve energy independence and also save consumers a lot of money over time by not spending so much on gasoline.
And in the speech yesterday, he mentioned that he's done this for cars, or his administration's done this for cars. He's looking at trucks next. Is that an important next step?
Yes, it is. Actually, he's done it for both cars and light trucks. The standards that go into effect for model year 2016, it's about 35 miles a gallon, and for model year 2025, it'll be 54 miles per gallon. But that's for cars and light trucks. What he wants to do now is get, I assume, heavier trucks would be covered, and that's consistent with the initial actions on passenger vehicles, essentially, you know, small SUVs and cars and vans. And this is really an incredible change. Many who've looked at new cars recently will see how much more fuel efficient they are because they're using smaller turbocharged engines and more efficient transmissions, and manufacturers are beginning to look for lighter weight vehicles. And then eventually we'll ramp up to buses and trucks, and even the military has exhibited a lot of interest in using biofuels mixed with conventional fuels to power aircraft and naval vessels. And so this is an effort that's not been noted very much that is really distinctive, I think, for this administration, much more so than was the case under President George W. Bush. And the president really hasn't received, I think, a lot of congratulations for moving the country in that direction.
Are automakers, you mentioned that they're having improvements, are automakers able to keep up? Are they going to hit the targets that are coming down from the White House?
Well, I guess that remains to be seen. But when the EPA and the Department of Transportation, technically the DOT sets the standards, the EPA does the testing, and they administer this together. When they set the standards back in 2009 with the initial agreement, and that was finalized in 2010, and then in 2012, the second set of requirements, the automakers were very much part of this process. It was automakers, environmentalists, energy experts. There were public hearings and opportunities to comment. The automakers very definitely agreed they can meet these standards if given sufficient time. So they have essentially 10 years to come up with markedly more efficient vehicles. Now, I expect if they can't do that in 5 years, they may say, can we, you know, extend the deadline? But I think there have been a lot of changes already, and every model year brings us more electric vehicles, more hybrid vehicles, more conventionally gas-powered vehicles. A Camry, for example, a relatively large sedan, getting 40 miles a gallon on the highway. That would have been considered remarkable 10 years ago, 5 years ago.
I think we are
moving in that direction.
Getting back to electricity production, in that quote we played from the president, it was one of the examples of him taking executive action, not waiting for Congress, saying, right, we're going to use public lands as a site for clean energy production. And what did you say, 3 million homes will be powered by this? Right. How's that going to happen?
Yeah, actually, one of the other little noticed developments under the Obama administration has been that in addition to oil and gas leasing, which has received a lot of notice, the Department of the Interior is leasing a lot of public land out in the West, particularly in California, and in the Southern California desert area, and I guess extending over to Arizona and Nevada, to develop very large-scale solar projects and wind power projects. And that's a dramatic increase. I see in some figures, for example, that we're increasing solar production on the order of 50% a year gain. That is there's been an enormous increase within the United States in solar generating capacity. Now, that's going to produce electricity to power homes, as the president noted. But the other comment he made relative to that is that we are slowly beginning to move away from using coal to generate electricity. In a state like Wisconsin, we are primarily dependent on coal. We just lost one nuclear power plant in Kiwami this year. They closed because it couldn't compete with cheap natural gas. But otherwise, we're still relying on coal. And I would guess what's going to happen with new EPA regulations that are now in progress, that we're going to see almost no new coal-fired power plants, and we'll see existing ones eventually retired and replaced by gas plants. And that also will mean lower greenhouse gases and probably more efficient generation of electricity.
One thing the president didn't mention is one of the most divisive pieces of energy policy, the Keystone XL pipeline. Republicans are saying for jobs, the economy, and energy, you got to get this thing going. The president's own party, especially toward the left, are saying, don't do this. Please come out strongly against it. Is that still going to be a divisive issue for months, maybe years to come?
Almost certain. I was a little surprised the president didn't mention it because he said so much more about energy and different technologies. But one statement he made towards the very end of this discussion of energy and the environment, he settled on climate change as an issue, and he said the debate is settled, climate change is a fact, And he made a very kind of moral statement about we want to be able to look our children's children in the eye and say we did what we could. Well, many people look at the Keystone XL pipeline as critical. If you can't say what the president did and then turn around and approve the XL pipeline, which uses a very, something called very dirty Canadian oil. Others are mixed about that and say, well, it's only one pipeline, it's just more oil. We, by improving auto efficiency standards, as I noted, we've already done quite a bit more than many other nations to improve our greenhouse gas emissions. But the president, by not mentioning that and highlighting his commitment to action on climate change, which would be done by executive action through the EPA, that is, through a regulatory process, not legislation. That leads me to believe he is not going to approve the Keystone XL, because many people will come back and say, how could you say that about climate change and then approve the pipeline? But it is, as you say, it's a very divisive issue, and the White House, I think, is being very cautious on making early announcements about this. Maybe they're waiting for some additional studies that would strengthen the president's position on it.
That'll be one for us to watch. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's Michael Kraft, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Green Bay.
Cyberbullying has gotten a lot of attention in the last few years, including the attention of online activist groups like Anonymous.
These groups work to punish those implicated in bullying or sexual assault cases, sometimes encouraging police to reopen cases that they had closed.
But there can be a complex side to this kind of activism, one that has critics calling activists bullies, just like the bullies are trying to punish.
Our guest took a deeper look into the online activist world. She's here to talk about what she found.
Emily Basildon joins us now. She's author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and a senior editor at Slate. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I want to start by getting our terminology straight. There's bullying, there's cyberbullying, and I wonder if you could sort of start by defining some of the terms here. And let's start with the activism that's going on online. Can you tell us about that and what it is?
Well, there are people who see stories, especially stories of sexual assault, that they think the authorities haven't addressed. And they kind of bubble up online sometimes because of news coverage and also because increasingly kids are taking pictures of things that happen at parties or social gatherings, and sometimes those pictures are used to humiliate girls. So when things like that start circulating on social media, there are people who are very sensitive to that and kind of are on the lookout and have their antennae up. And then if they feel like there's a real injustice here, they may take it upon themselves to do something about it.
And would you call those people cyber activists?
You sure. I usually think of them as internet activists. And some of them, as you mentioned earlier, are part of Anonymous, which is this very loosely defined collection of activists and hackers that's been around for the last 6 or 7 years.
Now, there have been a few key high-profile cases involving rapes that have come to our attention because of the sensational nature and often a sense that people have that justice hasn't been served. And these have been the sorts of cases that these cyber activists or internet activists have gravitated to. And there's one that you talk about in Nova Scotia, which is a good case point. I wonder if you could walk us quickly through that case.
Yeah, sure. So this case involves a girl named Rutaya Parsons. And when she was 15, she went over to a boy's house with a friend, and there was a lot of drinking and some sexual activity. And Rutaya woke up in the morning. She wasn't entirely sure what had happened, but she thought she had been raped by four boys. And there was a picture of one of the boys having sex with her that what circulated around her school, and she was called all kinds of names. And it was a really, really difficult time for her. She switched schools, but about a year afterward, she very sadly committed suicide. And one of the things that happened before she died was that the police decided not to prosecute any of the boys, either for the sexual assault or for the photo. So when the story of her suicide broke, her parents wrote posts online in which they were very angry with the criminal justice system in Canada for having let all of these boys go. And there were some internet activists who saw those posts and saw the news stories and decided that they wanted to pressure the Canadian government to reopen the investigation.
Now, you met one of the cyber activists who was involved in working to bring her, the people who had raped her, to justice. And his name was Ash. I wonder if you could tell us about him.
Yeah, he's a guy in his mid-20s. He lives in London. He works as an engineer, and he's someone who gets much more sense of fulfillment and satisfaction from his online activism than he was getting from his kind of day paid job. And so he saw these stories about Rehtaeh Parsons, and he had already, before that had happened, founded this small group called Op Anti-Bully. And the people in Op Anti-Bully had never met each other in person. They were from all over the globe. But they shared the sense of commitment to doing justice as they saw that, right? I mean, they're not part of any formal organization. No one had hired them, but they had put themselves out there in this role. And so they organized and started looking for the identities of the teenage boys whom Rehtaeh had accused of assaulting her. And the idea was to generate pressure on the police and prosecutors in Canada to take action.
What kind of methods do internet activists like Ash use to try to bring what they think of as justice to a case?
Well, you know, once in a while, people who do this work, sometimes they will do something really aggressive, like hack into someone's private social media account. That's clearly breaking the law. But oftentimes they don't have to do anything like that because people think that their identities are hidden because, for example, they're using, you know, a made-up handle on Twitter. But in fact, their Twitter account is linked to other accounts they have online that do use their real names. And so if you start kind of following the trail of digital breadcrumbs, it's not very hard to connect people up to their real identities. So often it's just a matter of putting the pieces together, honestly.
What motivates these people? It seems as though from your piece that they do get a kind of a high off doing it, but also, you know, maybe there's a white knight thing going on.
Yeah, absolutely. They call this white knight work, and I think they're a sort of a combination of motivations. I got a really strong sense that they cared very much about the communities they'd formed. They really felt like the people they were working with were people whom they could trust and whom they cared about deeply. Now, the group I wrote about, Op Anti-Bully, actually fell apart and had a lot of infighting during the time I was reporting. But the motivation was this one for community. And then I think also, you're right, they see themselves as riding to the rescue. They are vigilantes, but, you know, if you are sure that you're right and these people have a real sense of righteousness about their work, then the fact that you're kind of making up the rules on your own might not bother you. And, you know, anonymous generally tends to be anti-authority and very skeptical of mainstream law enforcement. So the people who I was watching and reporting on, you know, kind of laughed off the notion that the cops were objecting to the way that they had intervened in the case.
How do law enforcement authorities and police in the United States, how do they feel about people like this getting involved in cases?
I think generally people like this makes the cops nervous because no one can control them. The police don't know who they are. They just, you know, it's not like they're coming down to the station and saying, hey, I found this evidence and here I am. It's all happening through these kind of shadowy videos and press releases online. And the police also worry about people taking the law into their own hands and making threats, which is definitely something that internet activists like these do. So there's a real tension with law enforcement.
They also seem to be fallible, like everybody is. They don't always get it right.
Oh, that's true. You know, in the Rehtaeh Parsons case, the people I was following were very careful and did not, in the end, name anyone. But another group of people in Anonymous who were similarly trying to figure out these boys' identities released the name of a boy and blamed him for this crime. And it wasn't him. They had the wrong person. So, you know, you do have that problem. Now, the activists I was talking to, when I would ask them about this, would say, hey, you know, the police make mistakes too, which of course is true. But, you know, I think that whenever you have vigilante justice, you have the danger of people doing harm in the name of doing good.
And in our last 30 seconds here before we go to news, I mean, do you think, though, that they are performing a service, that they're coming in and filling a hole that the police aren't able to cover?
Well, I do think there's a real vacuum because there's so much going on online, you know, cyberbullying, stalking, harassment. The police have a really hard time dealing with all of it. And it's worth pointing out that in the Rehtaeh Parsons case, in fact, the Canadian prosecutors did reopen that case and they did bring criminal charges against two boys. And I'm pretty sure that just wouldn't have happened without these internet activists. So, you know, it sort of depends on how you feel about that outcome.
Well, we're talking right now with Emily Bazelon, author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. And we're wondering what you think about this.
You can call in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea of online activists taking on bullies, people who post harassing pictures, maybe who've committed crimes? Is it a good thing? Or are we trying people in the court of public opinion? Do you think these online activists are bullies themselves or tools in fighting bullying and sexual assault? Have you been a victim of cyberbullying like what we're talking about here? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We're talking with Emily Bazelon, author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. We're talking about the rise of online activist groups who take on bullies and sometimes pressure police.
And we want to hear from you. Have you encountered, or maybe your kids have encountered, harassment, bullying online? Do you feel sometimes like it's the Wild West where people can do and say whatever they want and there's really nothing anybody can do to police it? And if you think so, do you think it's good or bad that there are vigilantes online, in effect, who will try to police that? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Emily, right now, groups like Anonymous and their offshoot groups like this Operation Anti-Bully, they're amorphous. The members come and go. There are no rules that govern them. When there is dissension in the ranks, it just can lead to a falling out because there's no mechanism for dealing with that. Do you think that as we go along, they will become more organized and maybe codify things so that they can be useful and also be organized?
You know, I don't actually think these groups are going to become more organized. I think that the whole point of them is that they kind of rise and fall. They spring up when they see the need for it. And the people who are doing them don't want them to become kind of institutional. They like the idea that it's all very nimble and of the moment.
One of the stories that you talk about was the assault of a 16-year-old that took place in Steubenville, Ohio. That one was pretty recent. How did online activists address that situation?
So that was a case in which pretty quickly after pictures and accounts of a sexual assault circulated, there were arrests made. But there was also a lot of local discussion about whether there were other cover-ups going on of other crimes by student athletes. And an activist who was going by the handle KY Anonymous put out a call for evidence. Somebody sent him a video that was pretty damning of a group of boys laughing about this rape that had happened. And he put it up online. And the video helped turn Steubenville into a kind of national rallying cry about the problems of rape culture.
And what happened to the activist who started the ball rolling?
Well, he stayed involved in the case, and then he was raided by the FBI. And other activists thought that he had been involved potentially in hacking a site of the football team. He denied that. But there was this law enforcement involvement, and then he also started drawing a lot of attention to himself online, which is something that in Anonymous you're really not supposed to do. They really don't like the idea of people glory-seeking as for being part of the group. So he's become a pretty controversial figure within the group as well as outside it.
I'm curious about how the parents of some of these victims, how they perceive these activists. Does it seem welcome, like the cavalry is coming, or does it seem like an unknown force that's a little scary?
You know, I think that at first, parents are often nervous. You know, they usually don't know what Anonymous is, and it's just confusing. But as they see Anonymous having some results, then parents may warm up to them. So in the Rehtaeh Parsons case, Rehtaeh's mother was very nervous at first, but then she realized that the activism was, in fact, putting pressure on the Canadian government, and so she started to really welcome their involvement.
Having spent so much time with these groups, gotten to know the ins and outs and the infighting and sort of what made them tick, and having studied a lot of these cases and their outcomes, do you have personal feelings about this, about whether these groups are doing good?
You know, I feel very torn. It's partly because, you know, whenever you spend a lot of time reporting people, you tend to see their good sides as well as their flaws. And I felt like I could really understand their sense of injustice about some of these cases. On the other hand, if you take a step back, it is anxiety-provoking to think that people are taking the law into their own hands. There's just a lot of harm that can come from that. And I think that in some ways these people have a lot of power because they're dealing with technology in a way that a lot of times the police either don't have time to do or really don't have the skill and expertise to do. So I was left feeling very mixed about it and incredibly curious about how this new form of activism will continue to develop, because I really think that we're just at the beginning and we're going to see this more and more.
Now, you said there was a lot of harm that can come. What is an example of the most egregious example of harm that you've seen covering this?
I think the worst thing is people getting accused of crimes who are innocent and really being, you know, stigmatized online, having your name and picture and your identity exposed as being a rapist when in fact you didn't do anything wrong. That's a pretty upsetting, horrifying thing to have happen. And once a mistake like that's been made, it's very hard to put the genie back in the bottle, given how Google search results work and how much rumors can kind of spread like wildfire online. So that's the problem that I see. It's the collateral damage.
I want to go to the phones right now. Let's take a call from Sherry joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Sherry.
Hello.
Hi. What has been your experience with this?
Well, mine's not on a scale that serious. I'm just talking about cyberbullying to the effect of, like, when I go on Facebook, I'll play just a game. And, you know, when you're on the game, and, for example, it's The Price is Right, people will put in, hi, good luck, things like that. A few times that I have been on there, and I'm an adult, so I don't really feed into it, but there'll be people, there's a picture of me and my daughter on there, and they'll say, oh, look at that lesbian, she's an ugly fat hoe, and I think, golly, I didn't even do anything, but they have to hide behind the computer and be mean, and I know it's probably a young child, but I'll comment back most of the time I don't comment back, but sometimes I will, and when I did, then another girl jumped in, another Facebook profile jumped in, I'm assuming it was a girl, with her to jump on me, just keep calling me names and how ugly I was. And I just am thinking, wow.
Sherry, would you feel better if someone were there, I don't know, policing it or keeping people like that at bay?
Yes, I would. And Facebook, you know, you can sit there and report abuse, but no one ever gets back to you. No one ever follows up with you. So you don't really know if reporting it, really, if they're doing anything about it or kicking them off of Facebook. You never get the follow-up from it. So by clicking that button to say, I'm reporting it, are you reporting that person? Are they doing anything about it? I would love to have some follow-up and some feedback to find out if they are actually doing something about it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. Appreciate you calling in. And Emily, I mean, do you think that Sherry is like other people you've come across, people who might feel powerless when they're online?
Well, I do think there's an incredible amount of mean anonymous trolling going on online, which Sherry was just talking about, where you just feel like you're doing your thing or minding your own business, and all of a sudden people are trashing you for no reason. And that's one issue with anonymity. It gives people license for a lot of speech that I think if they had to attach their names to it, they wouldn't do.
How do you see the kind of online activism we've been talking about today? How do you see it evolving? It sounds like there are some people who are carrying that work forward, even as the groups kind of come and go. In general, it seems as though they will keep coming back to it and keep doing what they feel is right for justice online. What do you see happening?
Well, I think it's very fluid, but, you know, Anonymous, this group that we're talking about, that's sort of the umbrella, started off, first they were kind of a bunch of pranksters. Then they started having more of a political consciousness, but mostly working on issues surrounding free speech and the free internet. And now I think they're branching out into this white knight work involving sexual assault and injustice. as they see it, from law enforcement failing to do their job. And I also think that increasingly this will be not so much about hacking. That'll be a little of it, but it'll really be about figuring out how to do traditional political organizing online. So how to use Twitter to get people together in a way that then could lead to an action like a rally or some other way of putting, you know, pressure on a prosecutor or the police to change what they're doing.
Do you think it will come to the point where you're the parent of a victim, something bad happens, and you go, you know what, I'm going to go to Anonymous, and it's that simple. Everybody knows about it.
I mean, I think people are already trying to do that, and there's a little bit of just sort of random serendipity involved in which of these stories really catch the imagination of the activists. But there's another recent case in Merrillville, Missouri, where what began as a very well-reported investigative piece of journalism about a sexual assault and charges had been dropped turned into an opportunity for internet activism, and in fact the case was reopened, like the Rehtaeh Parsons case. And then at one point the mother of the girl who had made the allegations got upset about how the new investigation was progressing, and she called on Anonymous for more help. It was a really interesting moment where you could just see the dynamic unfolding.
Well, it's something to keep an eye on. Emily, thank you so much for joining us and talking about it today.
My pleasure. Thanks for your great questions.
We've been talking to Emily Bazelon, author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy.
We've been talking about Anonymous and other groups that do anti-bullying and other kinds of activism on the internet. Now, with the frigid temperatures Wisconsin has experienced so far this winter, and we're still feeling it now, we'll find out about a strange winter phenomenon, the frost quake.
Now, apparently these are happening all over the coldest parts of the U.S. and Canada. And here to explain what a frost quake actually is, we have Brianna Draxler, assistant editor for Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. Brianna, hi. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, so what is a frost quake?
So a frost quake falls into a category of events called cryoseisms, which are kind of like earthquakes, but that happen in the frozen parts of the world. And a frost quake happens on land where the soil or the rock during a warm spell gets saturated with water and fills in all those spaces between the rocks and the parts in the soil. And then a cold snap hits really fast. So the temperature drops really quickly and turns that water into ice, but there isn't enough space for it. So it expands really quickly, and to release the energy, it creates a big boom and shake of, you know, various sizes depending on how big the actual event was.
So just having a really cold temperature in and of itself isn't enough. It has to be that rapid change of temperature, right?
Exactly. So a lot of people have been saying that, oh, this year must be such a cold year that these are happening more often than usual, when in fact, you know, we're having these polar vortices, but we're having warm spells between them that's bringing the temperature up and creating a lot more thawing and melting.
Is that essentially what happens, you know, with ice on a lake when you hear those booms?
Yes, exactly. That's actually the other half of cryoseisms. Those are called ice quakes, and those are the kind that occur on water when you're on a frozen lake or you're ice fishing or you hear those big cracks where the ice is shifting.
I don't think I've ever experienced a frost quake, or not knowingly, I might have thought it was something else. What if I were at ground zero of a frost quake, what would it be like?
Yeah, it's kind of a unique experience. I haven't been in one myself, but based on the reports that we've been hearing throughout the year this year, they're pretty short. They only last about 2 or 3 seconds. A lot of times it's a big sort of explosive type noise. A lot of people think that something heavy has been dropped on their roof or that a wall in their basement has cracked, refrigerators pushed over, people falling out of bed. There's been all sorts of things that people have been thinking it's been to try to explain it. So it's usually the noise that people notice. And then sometimes you can feel a little shaking. But unlike an earthquake that's really deep in the earth, usually like a mile or two, these occur just in the superficial part of the earth. And so it's less than 5 feet. So they're really not causing a lot of shaking. Sometimes you can feel them, sometimes you can't.
I'm so glad we're talking about this, because I'm pretty sure that I had about 10 frost quakes this winter and wondered
really?
What the heck was going on.
Really?
Yeah, I kept looking up at my roof and wondering what could be banging up there, and now I think I know. So can it damage property?
You know, most of the ones that have occurred this year, which have been more frequent than usual, have not been causing any damage. Most of the time it's just the noise and the shaking, but about 2 weeks ago in Fond du Lac County, there was one major incident where a gentleman called the police. He thought his garage had blown up, and it was in the middle of the night when they usually occur because that's when temperatures are really cold. And it turns out he went out in the morning and his driveway had been split in two. The crack was 100 feet long and like 8 or 10 inches deep.
Wow, that's impressive. So it can actually cause some damage. These are called cryoseisms. Do seismologists record these? Do they show up on the Richter scale?
None of the ones that have happened this year have shown up on the Richter scale, but they have been found. The ice quakes especially have been found to show up on the Richter scale. I was doing a little research, and there was an ice quake on Lake Mendota in 2008 that registered a 0.2 on the Richter scale, and one in 1948 that was actually a 3.8 on the Richter scale.
Wow. So that
those
even,
ones are felt a lot more.
So maybe even a California would notice that 3.8. They probably sleep through all the other ones we've talked about.
Probably.
So where in the world are they happening most frequently this winter?
So the ones that have been reported are either in the Midwest or the northeastern United States, and then down in a band on the lower edge of Canada.
Okay, so kind of in the northern parts where you'd expect it this season.
Exactly, where you're getting those cold temperatures, but it's not so far north where that cold is consistent.
Is there a peak season, apart from, I guess, winter, is there a peak time of year, a peak month where they happen, or does it really just depend on the quirks of weather?
Well, typically it's at the beginning of winter when there are a lot more variations in temperature. We're getting warm spells and cold snaps, and in these cases, the cold snap just becomes literal.
Are people generally pretty frightened by these, like the guy whose driveway split in half? Are they kind of terrifying experiences, or are they just, you know, like mine, where I'm kind of scratching my head and hoping for the best?
I think it's a little of both. There have been a number of people, especially the ones up in Toronto earlier in the year, where a lot of people were calling the police wondering what the explosions were, whereas a lot of the smaller ones have just been sort of a social media phenomenon where people are wondering if anyone else is hearing this or if they made it up.
You know, I meant to throw this out earlier. If anyone out there has been through a frost quake this year or in the past, give a quick call real quick now at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Tell us your frost quake story. Brianna, since you wrote this piece, are people that you know coming out of the woodwork to say, oh, that's what that thing was?
You know, I haven't heard any of that yet. I think they're pretty isolated, and they're tough to track because, you know, there isn't usually any damage to see. They happen at night when you can't actually witness it, and there really is no way to predict it. So I haven't heard any of that yet, but we'll see.
Have any frostquakes been captured, say, on YouTube?
No, I have not tracked any down, but it is being manifested in other ways. There's actually a brewery in Ontario that just came out with a beer called Frostquake to celebrate the frequency of these occurrences this year, which has been far more than usual.
Already getting responses to that call about have you experienced a frostquake? First of all, from across the board here, Michelle Good says, she just typed, I felt the Mendota one. I thought the power plant exploded. And now we've got Dave on the line in Augusta. Dave, hi there.
Good afternoon.
You felt a frostquake?
A couple weeks ago on a Monday night, it was about 2 in the morning, I thought one of my big cottonwood trees had split and fell down to the ground. Nothing happened outside. It was a frostquake. I know it was. It woke us both up.
No kidding. Well, thank you so much for sharing that story, Dave. Looks like we've got another person with a frostquake story on the line.
And let's go to Bonnie joining us from Rice Lake. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi there.
Hi.
That's where all those things from.
So you felt this but didn't know what it was?
I had no clue what it was. At times I thought, oh my goodness, I was going to fall down.
All right. Thanks for that, Bonnie. We've got Libya in Ashland, too. Now, Libby, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say thank you. You have redeemed us. we experience this. I'm up right on Lake Superior pretty frequently when it's cold. And earlier this year, a neighbor and I were talking about it on Facebook, and people didn't believe us and said, it was in our head or it's your house settling. And it sounds like where our house is, it almost half the time sounds like a gunshot just went off outside, or someone's car just like smashed into a snowbank, and then you all run and you're like, oh wait, that's just that noise again.
All right.
Sometimes it does just sound like ice fell off the roof.
Libby, thanks. Brianna, you have convinced a lot of people of their sanity by researching this. Thank you so much.
Happy to help.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Brianna Draxler. She's assistant editor for Discover Magazine.